The second part of the interview with William Lightsell took place in Washington, D.C. on February 9th, 1988.
Mr. Lightsell, what was your assessment of general Iranian economic conditions during the late 60s and early 70s, before the oil price explosion?
Okay. Well, there were some inequalities in the economy and some certain leads and lags in terms of development, but in general, I felt very comfortable that there was a good, solid team of economic technocrats, good technocrats, managing the economy and allocating resources in a rational way, insofar as it was possible in a somewhat erratic environment, given the enthusiasm of the Shah and so forth. It was difficult to keep up with him sometimes. But in the, as one of the leftovers from the old days, we had, during the first 2 years of my stay in Iran, the so-called annual review with the Prime Minister and the American ambassador and whoever was allegedly running the aid mission at that time. And I took part in the last two, in the fall of 69 and in the fall of 70, between Ambassador MacArthur and Prime Minister Hodeida, and Mehdi Sami, who was then the head of the Crime Organization. They were not thoroughgoing reviews of the economy, but they did focus on the main thrust of the government's investment policies, the main thrust of the use of the foreign exchange, and were, to some degree at least, the basis for the justification of providing export-import bank loans for arms for them. That was run through the export-import bank. And so they were useful, but not very exhaustive, and certainly not very profound examination. But those annual reviews enforced a discipline, or seemed to enforce some sort of discipline, on the Iranian economic managers,
like the central bank,
the central bank plan organization, and so forth. Those ended sort of by mutual consent, because Prime Minister Shah thought, well, since there's no aid mission anymore and there's no aid program, fine, why the hell should we permit this unwarranted intervention in our internal affairs? But nonetheless, until about 1973-74, when the oil prices started going up, those two technocrats did quite a credible job of allocation of resources. So, and by the time I left, although the team had been disbanded to some degree and politicians were in place when I left in 74, politicians were in place, nonetheless, the general direction of the economy was still good.
Reasonably healthy.
There was some in the agricultural field. There was absolute chaos because they were moving into so-called agribusiness and industrial agriculture and so on, and literally screwing the small farmers. Prices were not permitted to rise at the farm level.
There were price controls
both through the producer and to the consumer. And they filled the gap because naturally there wasn't any protection coming in from the farms, or not very much anyway. But they filled the gap with imports.
What kind of impact did the land reform program have? Was there a positive impact by and large, or was there negatives?
Kind of hard to say, because without the freedom, without the freeing up of an agricultural economy, land reform itself became a political act rather than an economic act. And it was political in large part, and did break up a lot of large landholdings, and certainly there were a lot of small farmers who benefited from it in terms of gaining title to their land, but many of them were forced into farm cooperatives.
Corporations,
but they operated the same way. And of course, they had mixed experience with it. Some were showcases, the government poured lots of money into them, and so forth and so on. And you could always, there was one outside of Persepolis that every foreign diplomat and statesman had to go visit. I'm sure they paid everybody to be there. I think, land reform was one of the touted accomplishments of the White Revolution, so-called. And when I first got there in 69, the romance of it was still alive. But by 1974, such early supporters and admirers of land reform as Ann Lambton, a British congressman, had turned 180 degrees around and was quite critical of the implementation of land reform.
Equitable experts at the U.S. Embassy to sort of monitor the program, or
no?
Or the people in USA?
Aid Embassy closed up before I got there.
Oh, okay.
John Westberg, who was the lawyer, was the last one there. So there was no aid program.
So there's no U.S. technical assistance at this point for any of the program?
Except a couple of technical things, a regional full-time program, stuff like that,
yeah.
But nothing.
A lot of the secondary accounts of various writers have written about Iran in the 70s and 60s have argued that the Pahlavi family and its associates preferred to serve the economy through their control of the banking system on the political influence because of a misallocation of credit and financial resources because of the Pahlavi family's influence and such like that. How much evidence did you see of that?
Pahlavi's direct influence on the direction of loans, no, it was not that much. Certainly some of the institutions, as Bank Oman, which was an arm, as I recall, of the Pahlavi Foundation, but it was used to finance and run the PL4E program, so a lot of money rubbed off there. But in terms of running the banking institutions for the benefit of the Pahlavi family, I don't think that's a sustainable charge. There were enough opportunities for the Pahlavi family members to become partners in profitable businesses without distorting the banking system. I'm not saying that they were not active in banks on occasion, but it was not a publicly evident activity.
Okay.
Ashraf's first husband, his name right now, a very distinguished gentleman, was the head of the bank, but he was her husband.
This is the Shah sister.
Yeah.
Right. So, well, that's a question about the economic aspects of arms sales. What was did the embassy's commercial and economic staff play much of a role in arms sales matters?
Not really, except in the sense that we were called upon to provide the analysis of the economy.
Both for the end review.
Both for the end review and for, just general economic analysis of the economy for the purposes of the U.S. government generally. You know, we put out a six-month semi-annual review that was published on the classified thing. And we usually called upon to draft the economic justification for arms credits. We made our points mostly at that time when it came to use of foreign exchange. You know, there were lots of rules of thumb in those days about how much foreign exchange, or earnings, the percentage of foreign exchange earnings one should devote to servicing, loans, foreign loans. And of course, those rules of thumb have been long since gone by the board all over the world, but generally speaking, in those days, any country that was using more than 20 to 23% of its foreign exchange earnings annually to service foreign debt was considered to be in trouble.
Yeah.
Now, you know,
we're much over that.
Oh yes. Mm-hmm.
Now, when you look at these reports, did Amish Mag people scrutinize them?
Provided them to General Critchell and his successors and predecessors were always. Provided with our analyses, and that is not to say that they necessarily had much real effect on situations, because these arms recommendations were primarily political considerations. Although in General Critchell's day, he had a very strong feeling that there was a finite sort of rate of absorption of rational use of foreign military equipment and upgraded military equipment that an army such as Iran's could possibly use and use effectively. And he was not, his thesis at the time was that we had to try to fix what we were providing them with what they could rationally absorb. The economic justification found a good friend in that approach to arms sales. But the Shah, of course, was not persuaded, and on the political level, certainly President Nixon was not persuaded. Now, this is in the pre oil price.
That's right,
before
73.
Yeah.
Exactly. Could you give us an official name, David Olney, from ISA and the DOC?
Well, yeah, I ran into him, but you know, he had several. Dave Olney, Henry Cuss, who was one of his predecessors.
They all played a role in arms sales.
Yes, they all played a role. Yeah. And I've forgotten who the ones in the latter days were, but. They took their advice from the Army Schmag missions, and after the oil price increases, of course, other considerations, including what the Shah could afford to spend, or what he wanted to spend, rather.
Now, you came to the embassy in 59, was the Exim Bank already playing a role in financing on sales?
Arms and others. Right. Yeah.
Did any people from the bank come to
start? Well, the returns would come out quite often, every year or so, and, almost every year. And other bank officers would come out to assess the economy and talk to different people. And the World Bank always had its people out there, too, looking around and assessing the economy. And those analyses fed back into the U.S. system as well.
When it came to negotiations over, say, the interest rates for the loans, would be come with what would you always take place in?
No, the interest rates were out of our province.
Yes.
They
weren't.
That's the function of domestic U.S. policy.
Now, in 1971, the U.S. was running its first trade deficit since, I guess, the 1890s. More than the late 60s, early 70s, the U.S. aerospace industry was somewhat in the doldrums. To what extent did those kinds of considerations influence arms sales policy? From your vantage point in the embassy, were those things that were discussed?
Well,
they had a bearing on arms sales? Or?
Surely they had a bearing on arms sales, but not in that bold a depiction, because what we saw at that end was the competition between the various firms, the McDonnell Douglas's, the Northrop, the General Dynamics, the Drummond's, for sales of a particular type of plane or system. There was one effort by Lockheed to sell, this was, I don't know, still the economic option, the C-5 to Iran. That would permit the reopening of the line for U.S. purposes. Well, that was a slightly different focus, but the U.S. Air Force wanted some more C-5s. And in order to open the line, if the Shah of Iran, the government of Iran, would pay for a good deal of it, that would be helpful. And there was always a consideration that for every plane sold abroad, the average price of the planes, both to the foreign buyer and to the U.S. Air Force, would come down, because you were writing off the development costs over time. And that was a consideration, but not a main one.
During the embassy, did you provide assistance to companies who were trying to sell particular weapon systems to the... Or was that more a function of Amish Mag?
That was more a function of the political military and Amish Mag. But yeah, they usually came down and talked to me. And I say down to my office on the first floor as opposed to the political section on the second floor. They usually came to talk to me generally about the economic scene and about who was doing what to whom, just generally. And this involved the question of who's representative, they oftentimes toss names at me to see how I would react. I tried to steer away from endorsing any of them. Some were better, more honorable than others, not all of them.
Could you give them further indication who would be more reliable? Or could you possibly do that?
I really couldn't do that. I avoided making recommendations about anybody. If they asked me about somebody, I would say what I knew about them, how acceptable they were up from the palace, and what their general reputation for probity was in the business community. I had a little lecture about you have to decide for yourself whether you think you need that kind of representation or not. If you think you have a proposition that is saleable on its own and needs no personal representation or enhancement, then by all means, avoid it. If they want it bad enough, they'll buy it. But if you are out here selling snake oil, why then you decide accordingly.
Are you talking about the Iranian who serve as intermediaries between
yes.
the companies and the government?
The president of Albert Hakim, the Ashkhodis, the Abu Fatmadis, and the Kashmis, and the Hindujas, and so on.
Those were some of the people who were operating
those things.
So you could basically provide information to the firms. Could you go beyond that? What other kinds of assistance could be given besides simple information as to who the...
I had a slightly different view of my role in assisting U.S. business than some of my more timid colleagues in the Foreign Service. I felt that I was there to be helpful to them, and I wasn't there to play mother hen to all American companies and try to, if one came to me for help and nobody else did, I would give that one who asked me help. But if, say, General Electric and Westinghouse and Combustion Engineering all came to me for help, I would give them all equal help. But that didn't mean that I had to go, if only one of them came to me, I had to go say to the other two and say, hey, General Electric is after this, and I'm going to help them, and I'll be glad to help you too. That's not the way you play the game. And some companies felt the need for help and some didn't. And I take the view that those who ask for help deserve it. So I would make appointments, I would send people along with them to help interpret if they had that problem. I did a lot of things that were not in the ordinary realm of services that the economic council used to provide. I guess commercial activity is more so now than it used to be. I still get, I have complaints myself.
Also, the part of the experience.
Yeah.
I guess there were certain limits that were placed on what could be done for a company.
There are no legal limits whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, certainly there's some things that couldn't be.
Yeah.
But if the ambassador was willing, you could have him entertain some people with and for the businessmen. We didn't have this.
Those things that happened. I'm
sure that happened. The British ambassador used to do it all the time. And he gave a party once when they were selling the Airbus. No, wait a minute. No, 1011. Lockheed 1011 because it had Rolls Royce engines on it. And he gave a big party at the reception at the embassy for the businessmen and the military and whatnot and the air. Iran Air, who were going to buy it as part of support for British industry. British industry, but also supporting American industry.
Huh. Now, during our last meeting, you mentioned that you mentioned the problem of corruption in Iranian political and business circles, and sometimes they reach to the top levels of the Salafi family. And many writers have discussed this problem and its implications for the way American corporations did business in the country during the 70s. Now, how common was it for U.S. companies to actually use what we could call corrupt methods to make sales in the country?
Well, now let's back up a little bit.
Yeah.
The term corrupt methods is a misunderstanding of how you do business, not only in Iran, but all over the Middle East and in other parts of the world. We have a very puritanical view of the world, but when you do business in the Middle East, you do business their way and traditionally for thousands of years. I think I'm exaggerating a little bit. But the closer the throne you got, the richer you were supposed to be. Or the closer the throne you were, the richer you were supposed to get.
Mm-hmm.
It was just a fact of life in Iran and other milieus that if you were going to get something done, you had to pay for the services. Now, you in that sense, it is not corruption. When the payments become exaggerated and the services are of dubious value, then that is corrupting the system, but it's still not necessarily corruption in the given atmosphere. Now, we have said that, there were companies back in the 60s and 70s who used well-known intermediaries, some of them members of the royal family, and some of them not, but all of them close to the throne, to help get projects and contracts through. It was reasonably well-known that Abu Fatmati, for instance, was one of the premier 10 or 20 or whatever percentage it was. Court Minister Alam's daughters tried to play the game as well. My good friend Kay Kashri was another one who was pretty good at it. There were a large number of them with various degrees of entree into various portals. You know, some of them were in the palace, some of them were in the Ministry of War, some of them were in the Ministry of Power and Water and Power. It varied depending on what the contract was. That is not to say, however, that there was real venality. These were, I know, viewed in retrospect and viewed from the American point of view, sure, corrupt, bad business, uneconomic, all sorts of these, all of these nasty things. But it was the way business was done. Now, as we imposed over years our notions of public morality on other countries, including Iran, they took steps to try to comply with what they use as our requirements, but those requirements only applied to American businessmen. They didn't cover the French and the Germans and the Japanese and the British, and what the result was, we got left behind in many cases, except for those areas where we either had something that nobody else had, or it was in the military, for Shaw, for political and other purposes, was equipping his military with American military equipment.
But in other areas, typically, it was a disadvantage.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. 95%.
Now, this isn't more a question of, I assume that intermediaries are necessary.
They were, just as a statement of fact, yeah, that were necessary.
But that is not, but payoff would be another question. It's not really the one.
That's a payoff. Yeah. I mean, if you're going to pay a 50% commission, yeah, that's a payoff.
Yeah.
But if it's a 5% commission, even if it's on a $100 million deal, although companies as General Electric for a $100 million sale, the percentage of the commission concomitantly reduced, but it still came out to maybe $2 million, $2.5 million, which is a lot of money.
What's the 2%? Would that happen quite a bit?
For General Electric, yeah, that percentage they could pay as much as 12%, but that's on the smallest part. But when you got to a power project, $100 million or whatever it was, 2% was a lot. Now, in some of the other companies, and I'm colored now by my latter day experience, and certainly many of the non-American companies doing business were not as careful in the percentages as some of the American companies. And thereby, there was absolutely no way you could edge them out of the project if they were there, because they bought the information, no matter how careful they were, and so they managed to overdo you by a slight amount.
Do any classes of U.S. firms more likely or more far more necessary to rely upon, say, using payoffs to make sales than other kinds of firms? And what, like, they were smaller firms, more vulnerable perhaps than large corporations like GE?
In large corporations, that would pass for a large payoff in a small corporation was loose change. For small corporations doing small business, the percentages were higher, but it was simply reflected in the sales price that would happen to be a consumer good. Now, if you were in a joint venture, you could handle your problems by several ways, by giving a percentage of participation and with real investment, but maybe to a member of the royal family. There was no notion by the royal family member, in some of the cases that I can recall, that they were going to take part in management, that they were simply going to collect some profits. Now, there were some Iranian businessmen, one notable one, Haji Mohammad Taghi Barkordar, who probably had the largest single fortune in Iran before the revolution, without any, outside the royal family. Was very proud, but he never had a member of the royal family as a partner in any of his businesses. He had over 200 companies. It was a very important business time. Others were, you know, felt compelled, felt no constraints, I guess, in accepting members of the royal family as through legal cutoffs as members of the joint venture. And, you know, there were some areas of business, for instance, the importing of chickens that were sort of handed over to hangers-on of the royal family. But Madame Diva, the Empress's mother, was one of the biggest divas through her, not she didn't do it herself, in the importance of frozen and chilled chickens for many years. One friend of ours decided it was a pretty good business, and he would try to, and started to try to import. And he ran into more difficulties. He had more customs problems. He had trucking problems. He had distribution problems. He had breakdowns in his cold storage. And finally, someone wise enough, that this was Madame Diva's terrain, he was come from there.
I think from time to time the Shah had sort of crackdowns on companies that relied upon chaos and so forth to make sales until it became notorious. There was the Ruman case and the Malati case.
Were there things the embassy could do to help these companies? We always suspected, because Prince Shahram, Ashraf's son, was part of their coterie. And so we always suspected that he had been an intermediary for helping Tom Jones get the project. But it wasn't until it all came out later. The vice president of Norfolk Just Kitchen had to leave before then. I had dinner with him last night, and he got a golden handshake from Norfolk, but he had to take the rap. Again, that's looked at in retrospect, and we overlay our moral puritanism on top of it. It made it all look wrong because they wanted to make it look wrong. A group of, and I may have told you this last time, a group of young Iranian friends of the Prime Minister, he would get them together in a doré every month or so, and they would end up of some of them the young technocrats I was talking about, some of them representatives of very powerful families. There were 8 or 10 of them. They would get together for lunch or drinks or whatever. And at one point, because the Shah was on this corruption trip, they put together, he started collecting them for 6 months or so, put together dossiers of cases of corruption that they knew about, and could document to some degree. And it became, as I am told, I never saw it myself, a rather sizable piece of work. And they delivered it up to the Shah, and he looked over it and said, "My God, if I have to get rid of all of these paid people, I will have no one left to run the economy." With that, they took it all out and burned it, I'm told. Now, I know it happened. Whether it happened in exactly those terms, I'm not sure. That's a good thing.
Oh, I think that's what it was. Rashidi and Brothers, were they ever involved in Edward Bowers or?
Well, Rashidi Arms, yes. He ran something called, I'm trying to think his name, the two of them, one of them. Ran something called the Distributors Credit Bank, which funded all the taxis involved, the taxi cooperatives. Because the Rashidi Arms were instrumental in the 53 riots, and of course, they went back a long ways with the British intelligence service, etc. And yeah, they were widely rumored to be involved, but they went broke, or one of them did, as I recall. And
involved with company representatives or intermediaries.
Yeah, but he never represented the big ones. I went over there to their house shortly after I arrived, and General Griswold, I guess, was head of the International Bank of Washington. Still is, in fact, was their guest, and he was thinking of buying in the Distributors Credit Bank. Never, it didn't get through the central bank to get more approval because the Distributors Credit Bank was in such perilous condition it wouldn't fly. So did that farm and farm.
I think I saw a letter classified by Douglas Sack to that, of course, November 72. He mentions a sale by Bell of Texas to the helicopter industry. A sale of helicopters to Iran. And he went on to say that this is beginning to, this is a boon to Bell Helicopter, to Bell of Texas, and to various influential people on the Washington scene. Perhaps we can get an Iran lobby going. Was there any talk about an Iran lobby? Yeah, sure. Okay.
Well, this is, because this was in the early days, November 72, before real money started coming in. Somebody that would be suffering from Alzheimer's disease. I see why they mentioned Dave Allman. Fascinating. I don't show this guy. Yeah, at the time, I understand what his direction was. We were always concerned that the Shah was getting bad press at home, and he did. And of course, he brought it on himself. Because 1972, as I recall, was about the time when the 2500 we were getting close to 2500 anniversary. Celebration that we just had.
I think it was 71.
71, well, we just had it.
Fall of 71.
Yeah, that's right. It was fall of 71. And we got a lot of bad press on the Congress. Spent millions and millions of dollars out in the middle of the desert for something that no Iranian was going to see. So on that line. And so, by that time, the president's, President Nixon had pretty much decided that Iran was going to be our strong ally in the Middle East, and we're going to rely on them to keep the peace, with the British having moved out, and the Nixon Doctrine, so-called, forgot whether it had been enunciated just before that or just after that, but it was about that time.
It actually said it's 59, Guam. The
people.
Yeah, right.
We would provide them with the arms, but they would do our dirty work for it, or whatever you call it.
Yeah.
And we had chosen the Shah as our instrument. So we had a need for trying to see whether we could get better press for them. And they spent a lot of money on it, but without much real.
Who's
the? We're on the government.
Uh-huh. kind of wants to be pressed generally.
They bought a lot of had some PR advisors, I forgot who they were.
Oh, you had a PR firm?
Certainly Bobby Ray's at the time.
The same letter also mentioned something called Operation Enhanced Plus.
Well, that was
which I hadn't heard of before.
No, that was a military, I was not involved.
Oh, that's all I've got one.
You going to see what, see Butch?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Happy tomorrow afternoon.
Uh-huh.
Now, I wonder what the embassy, you have contacts with the local U.S. Chamber of Commerce. They had
I was instrumental in getting it started.
You're at the embassy?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. What's the story behind that?
Well, as we had the, story behind it, let me see. We had the American Businessmen's Association, something like that, I forgot what it was called. And it met sporadically, but we felt the need to find a way to help influence the Iranian authorities on issues that were helpful to American business being more active in Iran. And my word, the dates get all jumbled up, but with the big conference that Jim Lennon led
the
Rockefeller Conference. When was that?
70?
When
was the time?
He was a time life, but he was retired by then. But he was spending his time setting up the sort of thing. We tried to establish a chapter of the American Chambers of Commerce abroad, and didn't run. We succeeded somewhere along about this time. Because somewhere along about this time also, Henry Kissinger hit on the idea of the joint U.S. whatever it was, Economic
Commission.
And we wanted to have a role in the U.S.-Iran Business Council, which was usually associated with these commissions. And so we got the chamber established, finally, with the help of John Caldwell, who now works for Lynn Mopsinger and his company, who was the vice president and director of international affairs at the U.S. Chamber. And we created the U.S.-Iran Chamber of Commerce. And I as the embassy economic wala, was an honorary member or ex officio member, but I was as instrumental in getting that going as anybody. I kept pushing it and hosting people and so forth and so on.
Would you also have like 71 or 72?
Something in that order. The chamber grew by leaps and bounds, and of course we had Iranian members as well, representing American firms or doing business in the United States, and they represent American firms. And we had Iranians on the board. We had people like Rahim Irbadi and Rahman Rajavadi and a couple of others. And we had periodic meetings with the ambassador. And it was a useful PR and maybe even an informational thing. And on the other side, it gave us, and good our Iranian associates, a method for getting views critical of policy through to Iranian authorities without the Iranian businessman having to take the onus for being critical of the government.
In terms of policies that had an impact on American investment and trade.
And their own means of doing business. And as days went by, and as the wild days of the later 70s came along, they were more and more critical of their government's policies.
Which we'll get to later on. Well, who was the president, the first president of the chamber?
First president was John Cornell.
Of which?
Goodrich. Mm-hmm. He was out of Chicago. He retired. Lindsay. He was caretaker for the golf course, Michael.
But the member of the chamber would meet from time to time with the ambassador?
Oh, yeah. Not the whole membership.
But certainly.
They had monthly luncheons, and the board of directors would meet with the ambassador. This is a practice part of all over the world. Some form.
Did they meet with Iranian government officials also?
On occasion, yes. Especially with Minister of Commerce and Minister of Economy, and sometimes Minister of Finance. But John Sheila Musigar didn't like to meet people like that.
Why was that?
I don't know. Just distasteful.
Focus on the arms sales issue. So after oil prices started to skyrocket in late 73, arms purchases began to expand at a pretty phenomenal rate in the following couple of years. Did anybody at the embassy or in Washington sit down and try to think through the cost implications of massive arms transfers to Iran?
No, a lot of people did, and the view of the time in the embassy, because I left in the summer of 74,
right.
So I can't speak for much beyond that time, but